tell me about the nature of the social problem on which you work, and how do you define it? What is your organization's focus within it, and what is Indian Dispute Services seeking?
Well, you know that we work with Native American communities.
Yes.
We work mostly with tribes, of which there are probably around 550 of those in this country. And then we work with rural Indian community organizations, you know, health organizations and other kinds of organizations providing mainly health, housing, and social services, educational services to urban Indian populations.
Okay.
But most of those are within California. And the tribes, we work with tribes in California, but we also work with tribes, you know, we've been as far east as the Seneca Nation in New York, up in upstate New York, in the southwest, and we've done a fair amount of work in Alaska with Alaska Native villages, for the most part with the Athabascan in the interior, through some Indian organizations up in that part of the country.
Okay.
And I would say there's a whole raft of social problems that they have, but our main focus is building internal capacity for self-determination.
Okay.
With the ultimate purpose of strengthening them in their relationships with their external environment.
Okay.
So there are all sorts of ways we intervene, but in 99% of the cases, what we're doing is introducing a way of resolving matters, disputes, I want to say, but also even before disputes, helping tribal governments gear up for handling decision-making collaboratively and successfully. And there's an awful lot of dysfunction in tribes because they've been devastated by external conquest, and it's taken an awful long time to recover. And, their social systems were destroyed, their economies were destroyed, their political systems were replaced with a government, federally, you know, designed template called the IRA Constitution.
Yes.
In 1934, actually under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the Feds came up with a template for a tribal constitution called under the Indian Reorganization Act.
Yes.
And that was really imposing a democratic representative government, but it had its shortcomings as well. And it was always seen, and still is, as sort of externally imposed system of government which supplanted traditional forms. Now, in many cases, it didn't supplant anything because the traditional forms were destroyed.
Yes.
But what the tribes really have difficulty with is with process for dealing with controversy or disagreement or differences. They don't design process very well where people can come together in an atmosphere of safety and predictability and order, and then, you know, find themselves in an atmosphere that's conducive to informed and orderly decision making. That's a big problem.
Do you see that as a result of the devastation that has been visited upon them, or are you...
Well, I'm sure that's part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, particularly in California, there were a lot of tribes that were actually terminated in the late 50s, early 60s, and so there wasn't any tribal government, and no tribal community, and those, many of them have been restored. So what that means is that people from... There's an ingathering of people that have, for maybe several generations already, lived off the reservation with different kind of exposed to different culture, different values, often very low income, and they come together trying to make a tribal community out of their, you know, their varied assortments of people and agendas and contexts. And so that's difficult. They're trying to recreate something, and often they don't have much recollection of what they're trying to recreate.
Yeah.
So, and I also think I've had a lot of experience with, for instance, Mexican farm workers in the valley here in California when I was a community organizer, and some of the difficulties of getting people to work together and trust one another and come together in a organized and, you know, orderly way is a challenge for all low-income communities.
Yes.
So there's a little part of that, too. What, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, no, I absolutely do. I'm particularly, if I understand what you're, I think key to what you're saying is that there is a common heritage. However, because of the separation for a period of time, the coming back together and trying to recreate community without an ancestral knowledge of the culture really requires reinventing.
You're absolutely right.
Yes.
You say it very well. But I'm also saying that part of the difficulty of getting these communities to work effectively together is a function of their low income and low educational status.
Yes.
They're preoccupied with getting by, and they haven't acquired the civic engagement skills and volunteerism and that kind of thing that one finds among middle-class communities.
Yes.
You know, when you look at the kids in school, for example, who participate in school government, it's not the low-income minority communities generally, it's the middle-class communities. So that's a problem, too.
Yes, yes.
So what we do is we do a lot of training in what we call cross-cultural communication, which really is how to deal with differences, not only ethnic differences, but religious, gender, age, generational, geographic, all those differences that people have such difficulty with because they're pretty ethnocentric and ego-centered themselves. So their contexts are very narrow. So that's part of the training we do, and then we have a training in just collaborative decision-making and interpersonal negotiation and teach people sort of some processes and skills in working things out by talking things through. That's our definition of negotiation.
Okay, all right.
And then we're also training and certifying mediators.
Ah.
People that can work and as mediators in the Indian community. And we've really trained hundreds of people to do that, and it's not that necessarily that they hang up a shingle and become mediators, but the mediating skills are very important for program managers, for supervisors, for people who sit on boards, just to understand how you build agreements and get people away from the adversarial positional negotiations where differences seem to be more important than commonalities.
Yes.
So those are things we bring to Indian organizations as well as tribal government. And then we also are assisting them in their external relationships, often training and coaching negotiating teams that are sitting down with county, state, and federal agencies. Sometimes we've actually sat on there as a member of their negotiating team and kind of brought them along in the course of the negotiation itself. But our purpose is really to build the capacity among tribal leaders to be their own spokespeople, and we urge them that they not rely on lawyers, but that they can put them on a team and have them one, you know, as sitting as one member of the team, but never to rely on lawyers to do their speaking for them.
Yes. And it sounds like you are encouraging them to view you in the same way, to not rely on anyone else, other outside resources, but to build that capacity from within, using the resource possibly as one member of the team, one resource, but not to count on it as the...
Exactly.
Yes.
That we try to get them to see, too, that it doesn't have to be exclusively Indian this, exclusively Indian that, mm-hmm. but that they need to maintain control and direction, and they have to be clever about pulling in resources that are going to help them do the job.
Yes.
So we've been involved in a lot of disputes between the tribes and outsiders, which is one of my favorite things to do, actually.
Okay. Tell me about
one
that.
One of the things we've done in a number of different communities is assist tribes to negotiate with their local school district.
Okay.
Public school district. And we approach it by training Indian parents and tribal officials
mm-hmm.
For 3 days in cross-cultural communication, negotiation, government-to-government negotiation, and then we walk across the street and we give equal number of people on the school side that same training, teachers, administrators, and hopefully some school board members.
All right.
And then we ask them both to send, you know, a team to the table, and we mediate their negotiations and come up with a whole series of agreements regarding reforming the school to better address the educational needs of Indian kids. And that's extremely powerful, because what happens is that the individual parent is no longer going alone, fending for himself and defending their kid, but they've realized through the training that there are a lot of other parents that feel the same way, and that they can go in as a block, as
mm-hmm.
a collective.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have to go in and smash and knock heads, but they can go in from a position of strength and confidence and know how to create a safe environment so that there can be an open discussion. And they come in, when they come realizing that they come from a position of strength and preparedness, they don't have to be yelling and screaming and
yes.
complaining. But and then the school is much more receptive, and the school is also has an opportunity to look at the problem much more holistically than just the problem of a particular kid. And it's quite interesting, because the school staff invariably is very apprehensive
mm-hmm.
about being called racist. And every time, I mean, they have their litany of complaints too, which are as valid as the tribal parents. And they discover that it's not one person, it's not the school's fault exclusively, it's not the parents' fault exclusively, but they share in the responsibility of changing things and addressing the needs of the kids. And it's quite exciting.
It sounds like it's exciting. Can you share with me, without, you know, divulging any confidences, certainly, but a particularly tough situation possibly that you have gone in to negotiate? And how did you go about getting each side to agree to and value the process enough to go through it?
Well, I can tell you that's a great question, and you're obviously a mediator yourself, and you know that 50% of the task is getting people to the table.
Yes.
So one of the examples I think of immediately was a tribe here in the Sacramento area that had been terminated.
Okay.
And the folks, the remaining people, so they're no longer a federally recognized tribe.
Right.
They've been wanting to get restored under the same sort of legal arguments that 18 or 19 other tribes in California were restored.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have the funds, and they've had internal division that's kind of handicapped them. They've been at each other's throats, two main kind of factions. And the fact that they wanted to get restored was actually the motivation for trying to get together. But,
okay.
But it took, actually, what the Bureau of Indian Affairs was involved in Washington in creating an omnibus bill. This was in 1999, where I think seven or eight tribes would be restored by congressional action.
Mm-hmm.
So this group, Wilton Rancheria, Miwok Rancheria, was told that if they could get their act together, they could reach internal agreement that they would be included in that omnibus legislation.
Okay.
So...
that's an incentive.
Yeah. We approached both sides, and it actually took a year until we got them to come together. One group was more motivated than the other. The other eventually agreed. Our strategy was to have both sides get to know us.
Mm-hmm.
So we went and attended a lot of house meetings over that year, trying to move them forward and get them to agree. But once we finally got them together, we spent, I think, actually it was five consecutive days with them.
Okay.
But the first day was spent exclusively coming up with some procedural ground rules that made them all feel safe and secure, and that it was, you know, going to be a process they could make some progress in. And I think there were 26 ground rules that they finally agreed to.
Mm.
And they got some experience agreeing, which was really helpful.
Yes.
And they began to see that we were even-handed and were committed to making sure that each of them had what they wanted, and we told them both that we wouldn't be satisfied unless both of them felt their interests were satisfied. And it was rough. It was the feelings there were very raw. There was a lot of emotion. In fact, there was a point where in the third day, I think, that I kind of pushed both sides in an open session into kind of letting us know what was really going on, and there was a lot of crying.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of pain was revealed. I mean, these people were cousins.
Mm-hmm.
That had grown up together in one another's houses, and then at some point it all turned and they weren't welcome in one another's houses.
Mm-hmm.
And they were misinterpreted and maligned, and things were said and written about one another, and I mean there were a lot of a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very cathartic once the emotions were displayed and people were starting to reveal what was going on. And we got an agreement after five days of pretty hard work.
Oh gosh, I'm listening to you and I'm knowing how hard that work can be. Let me ask you.
We used the caucus very successfully.
Okay.
I don't know. Wanted to ask that, but the we would go in the private session with one, and I said, "Well, what do you think?" I said, "Oh God, they're just giving us the same bullshit they
mm-hmm.
gave us all this time. You know, they're not serious about this." And we said, "Well, what are you proposing?" "Well, we're not going to propose anything." We said, "Well, you have to give us something to work with here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, propose something. It doesn't mean that they'll accept it. It means that we can encourage them to modify it and send it back.
Right.
But we got to move.
Let's
and we got to work with
something."
Let's get
something on the table, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so it was quite dynamic. And every time we've done an internal mediation, we've done a number of them, it follows the same pattern. It's very painful.
Mm-hmm.
You feel like you're doing divorce mediation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I want to say before I go to another subject.
No, please.
That that this was done in 1999.
Okay.
And in May, I was called by this group. Could they come in and visit with me? And I said, sure. So one evening at 6:30.
May of this year.
May of this year.
Okay.
Yeah, 4 years later.
Okay.
14 of them show up. Everyone that was involved in that mediation 4 years ago, they show up.
Mm.
And they have one question to me. They said, Stephen, is this mediated agreement still valid? And so I said, well, before I answer, let me ask you some questions. What are you doing? Where do you want to go? Turns out they want to go for restoration now, and they have someone offering them, investors approach them about gaming and,
mm-hmm.
and so on. And what they're basically, after they're talking, I say, you know, I think you've come in here for one purpose only. You want me to tell you that this mediated agreement is still valid.
Mm-hmm.
And so they all laugh. And I
yes.
said, you know, I think this mediated agreement is still valid. And what was so clear was that here they had gone through this grueling process of coming up with an agreement.
Yes.
And it's really the only thing they've had to keep their community intact and protected against sort of some challenges from within.
Mm-hmm.
And they're basically feeling that if they abandon that agreement, they'll go back to square one.
Yeah.
So over the last 4 months, we've been working with them again. But it was really, for me, it was very satisfying to see how negotiation and mediation, how critical it is as a way of bringing people together and making progress.
Oh, yes. Can you tell me, because you are working with a people who, though their sense of ancestral history has been assaulted, there appears to still be certainly a strong drive to claim and to connect with it.
Yeah.
How do you see, or do you see, that awareness introduced into the negotiation process? And I guess I'm thinking particularly of the spiritual leaders.
Well,
do they play a particular role in the process?
Well, I'll answer it without first talking about spiritual leaders. It's very important when people go to the negotiating table that mm-hmm. they're authentic,
yes.
and that they're bringing themselves and their essence to the table,
yes.
that they're not trying to be anyone they're not. They're not feeling that, you know, they have to conform to the white man's way of
mm-hmm.
presenting themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of our training when we're preparing people to go to the table is urging them to be authentic and proud of who they are
mm-hmm.
and to bring that to the table. So I'll give you an example. I was involved with a tribe out in Death Valley, the Timbisha Shoshone, who had been stripped of all their land in 1933 when the federal government created the Death Valley National Monument. They
yes.
just ignored the fact that there were a tribe out there, the Timbisha Shoshone, that had been there probably hundreds, maybe even 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd been trying to get a land base ever since 1933, and then they had a break. There was some federal legislation and that called, actually there was a provision that the tribe and the California Indian Legal Services were able to insert into the California Desert Protection Bill that called for a study by the Department of Interior of lands suitable for reservation for this tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And the study was supposed to be done in conjunction with the tribe, in consultation with the tribe.
Okay.
So when the tribe prepared for these meetings, they were thinking negotiation. The feds actually were thinking, well, we'll just listen to what they have to say and then we'll probably go back to our office and do what we thought we'd do anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, what I wanted to say is that when the tribe went to the table and made their initial presentation, what they wanted to do was ensure that the feds who were coming in to the valley to meet with them Death Valley,
mm-hmm.
understood that they were guests, not the
tribe.
And so the tribal spokesperson, tribal chair, older woman, elder, 76 years old,
okay.
she spoke for 10 minutes in Shoshone and greeted them in
I'm
her language.
Chills.
In her, yeah. their language.
Yeah.
And basically, they communicated that they were happy to host them, but that they had a different way of looking at things. They had a different culture. They were people who had been part of this, integral part of this land for a long time. And the negotiation consisted of teaching the feds about how they've lived out there, what the desert means to them, about their language, about their religion, culture. They had an anthropologist working with them from the University of Nevada that actually developed a slideshow of the traditional resource management techniques. So, well, we're very conscious of the fact that people have to use these every opportunity to teach non-Indian what Indians feel about things, think about things, want, and it was very powerful.
Powerful. Yes. Now, you say she spoke for 10 minutes in Shoshone?
Yeah. And she spoke, I mean, the only people that understood it were the tribal members who attended that first meeting.
Yeah, at least the only people who understood it on a cerebral level.
Yeah.
But yeah. I'm sure on other levels, even that 10 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
One message that was pretty consistent was that when they met with the feds the first time,
mm-hmm.
the tribe did, they said, you know, they asked the feds, and they were four or five different agencies represented, National Park, Bureau of Land Management, Forest Service was there, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. We finally got Department of BOR, Bureau of Reclamation, there too.
Mm-hmm.
I lost my train of thought. But so the first question from the tribe, or one of the first questions, was, okay, feds, you understand that actually this is tribal ancestral land, right? There's no question about the fact that the tribe has been out here for a very long time, and this is and part of their ancestral homelands. And the people looked, and they said, I mean, wasn't that established when we were federally recognized out here in 1985?
Right.
Everyone nodded.
Okay.
So, okay, there's no question. This process isn't reexamining whether the tribe belongs here, right?
Right.
Okay, so everyone accepts that this is tribal ancestral land. So the way we figure it is that this is basically our land, and you are guests here for the last 65 years since the feds took this monument over. But what we want to tell you is that instead of our coming to you and trying to justify why we should get part of our land that belongs to us, you should come here and try to justify why you should stay. And
how was that received?
With blank looks.
Yeah.
They had no response. But again, the tribe was positioning itself.
Yes.
You know, it was part of our strategy.
Yes, absolutely. In the same way that maybe the words were not understood when she spoke in Shoshone, but the energy and the essence came across. These were people who felt their sense of power, and they were not asking for anything.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Well, and they got maneuvered to ask.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
These federal agencies who came to consult said, well, what are your proposals? What do you want?
Mm-hmm.
And so the tribe laid out that they wanted 750,000 acres brought into trust and a big parcel of 5,000 acres in the Death Valley sort of headquarters in Furnace Creek. And basically the Fed said that's too much.
Mm-hmm.
And no response, no explanation. They said it just wouldn't be politically feasible.
Hmm.
And this is a fairly long story, but I'll try to shorten it. At that point, then, this study was supposed to be complete, and the tribe had objections to the drafts. And finally, there was a third draft, and there was no real good, solid response by the feds, who now were rewriting this report exclusively, even though initially it was going to be jointly prepared. And the National Park Service really dominated, and they came finally to the last meeting and said, they came actually to the two planners from National Parks Service came and said, okay, now we want you to sign off on this. We have to send it back to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And the tribe said, we're not going to sign anything. You're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And the Park Service said, oh, by the way, remember when we talked about you getting 40 acres of land for your reservation? Well, we've taken that off the proposal as well, so that we're not recommending any land for a reservation here within the park. With that, the tribe just went ballistics.
Yeah.
And they said, to hell with you, and they cut off any further communication for the next 2 years. But luckily, that was followed by a very successful process where there was really good, solid government-to-government negotiations ultimately a signed agreement that became the basis for congressional legislation, and they established, under the Timbershaw Homeland Act, a reservation of over 10,000 acres for the tribe out there.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Plus, an agreement to designate 1 million acres of that park, which is, I guess, about 4 million acres, as the Timbershaw Natural and Cultural Resource Preservation Area. So now, instead of the tribe having 850,000 acres in trust, they actually have about 1 million acres, not in trust, but reserved for co-management experience.
Oh, wow, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
That is impressive. Tell me, you know, and you have the questions before you, and
yeah.
I have the questions before me, and we're actually going through all of the questions, and I'm not going to break the flow of our sharing by trying to go through those, because you're answering it, and I appreciate that. Let me ask you, though, about, and possibly we're getting at some of this in the breakdown of the first round of talks.
Yes.
In the story you're sharing, and then the coming back and having such success. Are there, I put it in quotes, failures that you have experience that caused you to do something differently? What enabled you to come back, and what did you learn from that first go-round that enabled you to come back and be so successful the second?
I think this is a very important lesson when for mediators and for the mainstream mediation community.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they realize that it's a very different proposition when you're working with communities and people that are effectively disenfranchised.
Yes.
Because getting to the table and having counterparts on the other side of the table that take you seriously requires a lot of work. And what this Timbershaw Shoshone case study really illustrates is that the first round, the feds weren't prepared to negotiate or acknowledge that this tribe was significant. In fact, it was, to them, there were 300 people that they wished would go away.
Mm-hmm.
And so they weren't there to negotiate. The tribe was.
Right.
The tribe was assuming that this would be a bilateral negotiation where both sides were committed to reaching agreement, but not the feds. And so
For the feds, it was a politically expedient placating process that they were going to go through and
yeah.
then go on and do what they were
and
going
they didn't
to do.
Even know that it was politically expedient, because they didn't think that there was any attention paid to by people who had political importance.
Yeah.
So it wasn't on the radar screen of Secretary Babbitt in Interior at the time, that he had an operative that was trying to, you know, get rid of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the planners came from Park Service to tell the tribe that there wasn't going to be any recommended land within the park, but that they were recommending only land outside the park that belonged to the BLM, the tribe went crazy, and they decided that they would organized nationally against the Park Service,
mm-hmm.
and that's what they did.
Okay.
So they established a national alliance to protect native rights in national parks,
mm-hmm.
which means they aligned themselves with several very key tribes in the country. The Miccosukee in the Florida Everglades, who has been battling the Park Service for the last 30 years.
Right.
The Navajo, who have their own national park and problems with the National Park Service. The five Sandoval tribes in New Mexico. The Sioux, I guess, with Badlands. The Blackfeet Glacial Park. A number of other tribes.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all... They met in Las Vegas and created this organization. Actually, I facilitated a 3-day meeting to pull this organization together. We had 30 different Hawaiian communities represented. So the strategy was to have press releases and to call for congressional oversight hearings about how the National Park Service's policies toward Indians.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really threatening to expose them, and we spent a lot of time being in contact with congressional and senatorial, you know, leaders, and particularly the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. The tribe picketed the Park Service out there in Death Valley. They had a whole national fax campaign where letters were written. They handed out literature in Death Valley in 4 different languages, Japanese, German, English, and I forget what. So people all over the world were writing letters to the president, being, you know, indicating their outrage that this day and age, the American government would throw the Indians off their land. And so all of this sort of built up. We had a lawsuit that against the Bureau of Land Management for violating its procedures. I'm trying to think of all the various
tactics. This is phenomenal.
We wore them down.
Yeah.
We wore them down, and then actually I was sent to Washington by the tribe, Washington be willing to talk. Then they were surprised that the tribe was willing. And they said yes, and then the next 6 months were spent negotiating a process which called for the use of an outside neutral, a lawyer out at the University of Colorado Law School. We talked about, there was a whole agreement on process. The feds had to have someone from the assistant secretary's office. The tribe insisted on it. We weren't going to just talk with Park Service. We wanted representation all the way up to the secretary's office. We insisted that if we are dealing with 4 agencies, that they had to have an interagency task force dealing with this negotiation. We didn't want to go down the line, get agreements at the local level, and discover that there had been no communication between the locals and their hierarchy. So we insisted from the very beginning that be dealt with.
Oh, my.
So we knew a lot from our experience out there what needed to be done, and we obviously, the tribe, was in a position of greater strength after slamming the Park Service, you know, publicly.
Yes, yes.
And the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, I know for a fact, because I had got pretty close to one of the Senator Inouye's aides, she said they actually asked Secretary Babbitt, why can't you handle this? Why does this have to be out there festering in the press? Why can't you deal with this? And so, and eventually, Oh, there was something else, actually, that occurred that I found out only after I had written my article about this. Around the same time, the Miccosukee were entering an agreement with the Park Service, and the Park Service was so intransigent that the Secretary Babbitt and people from the Senate Committee took it over and rubbed and really eliminated the Park Service from the negotiations. And they settled it in a way that probably didn't please the Park Service. So the Park Service was apprehensive that they'd get shut out of the timber sale process if they didn't change their tune.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And really, I think, to be quite honest, there was a new person from the Park Service that headed the federal team that was really exceptional. And he understood the importance of negotiations. He was the director of the Pacific Regional Office of National Park Service.
Okay.
And, I mean, his first meeting with the tribal chair, mm-hmm. he looked at her across the table and he said, "It's a real honor for me to sit down with a leader of another nation."
Mm.
And that was a great way to start.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah, absolutely.
And the relationship was great that he developed, actually with me and with the chief spokesperson. But at one point he said to her, he says, "I'm not afraid of you, Pauline."
Oh, that's wonderful. He's acknowledging.
Yeah, he was. And, I mean, we got into a tiff. I mean, really, he took exception to some things I was saying, but... at one point, we were trying to determine the size of the land for their headquarters,
mm-hmm.
and I made a suggestion. He was angry at me for some things I had said that morning. He stood up and he said, "Don't you ever dare suggest that." And I said, "Well," he said, "Is this the tribe speaking?" And I said, "Actually, I have to apologize. I haven't cleared that with the tribe." It was just a stupid thing. He said, "Every time you talk, Stephen, it's for the tribe." So, anyway, we recessed.
But now, what was your role in that?
I was sitting at that point on the tribe's negotiating team.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then everything that you would say would be in the interest of the tribe.
Well, but he was trying to divide me from the rest of the
negotiators. Yes.
So, after the recess, he came in the room and I smiled at him and I said, "You know, John, I still love you." And he threw his arms around me and hugged me.
Wow.
And he said, "You know, Stephen, I love you." And then the third party neutral, the guy that was facilitating this,
mm-hmm.
big old Charles Wilkinson, came over and he threw his arms around the two of us.
Oh my!
Everyone must have thought we were absolutely nuts. But what had happened by then? We were probably 5 months into the negotiation, the serious negotiation. The relationship had developed so that there was trust and excitement about, you know, getting through this and creating a very novel agreement that all of us were proud of.
Yes, and it sounds like. Certainly, the you are coming in with a knowledge of and appreciation for the process. The third party neutral is coming in that way, but the new person representing the United States government, if you will, also came, and because of his perspective and his willingness to acknowledge, it opened up and an environment was created where the process really could be valued. And and as you shared in the beginning, even in dealing with some of the internal strife between the tribes and that it's painful, but when you value the process, you trust and you continue to work in that direction.
I think it's very well,
well
said. The key in my mind
mm-hmm.
to the success was the fact that there was a process defined before we dealt with the substance that people began to trust. And I'll tell you, the feds had no understanding of how negotiation works. They really don't have any experience in negotiation. It was us, really.
Yeah, I heard the education. I heard you educating all along the way.
Yes, and
even insisting that they establish a level of communication interagency that they did not have.
Right. Yeah, and I had to explain to them what happens to negotiation if you don't have that kind of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happens when you send people to a table and you haven't authorized them to do anything, they're not in communication with
mm-hmm.
you, and the other side's trying to figure out win-win, how do we make a proposal that's going to accommodate their interest as well as ours, and there's no one communicating what their interests are.
Right, right.
Or
yeah.
reaching agreement with people who contend that they have that authority.
But who don't have the authority. Right.
And then the tribe suspects that there were hidden agendas, and the reality
mm-hmm.
was that there was no agenda at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that, I think what John Reynolds brought was a lot of goodwill, a lot of experience, and I think that he began to see that we knew what we were doing. And he told me that. In fact, when he met me first, he said, "You're the guy that's been writing those great letters." He said, "I think we have the basis here for a good negotiation."
Oh, that's wonderful. And what was his position? What was the position?
He's the director of the Pacific Coast Pacific Regional Office of the National Park Service.
Okay, all right.
And he's since retired. But
mm-hmm.
he told us that the height of his 35-year career was being part of this negotiation.
That sounds like it was just a rich experience for everyone.
Absolutely,
yeah.
For everyone. Everyone took credit for it.
Yeah, and then you know something is happening that's good.
Yeah, and what the federal agencies had to come to was to realize that actually engaging in negotiation is not acquiescence of their mandate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they think that most agencies will tell you we can't negotiate because we're mandated by Congress to make decisions in this area. We can't give that away to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
That's our sovereignty we're protecting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But what I think our example really showed was that agencies could sit down and negotiate, protect their vital interests, not sacrifice those, but to make sure that the interests of others were also met, that the win-win is not a sacrifice of anyone's sovereignty.
Yes, that you're able to define something that's much bigger together.
Yes.
Yeah.
The more value created.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. How was the independent mediator selected? What was that process like?
He's someone that we all knew.
Okay.
He was actually close to Babbitt and some of his top leaders. A guy named Getchy, who was very close to Babbitt, was a friend and colleague of Wilkinson.
Mm-hmm.
And Wilkinson has a lot of background. I think as a young man, he worked with the Native American Rights Fund in Boulder. And he's well thought of.
Okay.
He's a very fair guy, fiercely kind of partisan in the sense that he's promoting people's rights. And,
yes.
And he's an expert on water and the West.
Mm-hmm.
So tribe felt comfortable with him, actually throughout the process, and so did the feds.
Mm-hmm.
So he was just really perfect.
Yeah, and it sounds like his work made it possible for him to be an apparent choice.
Yeah, and he didn't do a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he kept us together, and I think he gave us both the assurance that as maybe gnarly as some of the discussions became, that he'd make sure that we kept talking to one another. You know, that's
he seemed to be a manifestation, a symbol of the process.
Yeah.
That you were valuing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I asked a mentor of mine, I don't know if you've ever heard of Thomas Colosi.
No, I haven't.
A very prominent, successful mediator in this country.
Okay.
And I asked him, I said, Tom, does sitting on this tribal negotiating team undermine my credibility as a neutral?
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, in the long run.
Right.
And he said, you know, I think mediators negotiate and negotiators mediate. And he said, I think that when I do a mediation, Tom does a mediation,
yes,
he looks for someone on each side who is like me, who understands the mediation process. Because what he said is that negotiators who have that kind of orientation understand that it can't be one-sided, that it's going to, you have to vigorously pursue your own interests, but you also have to spend an equal amount of time accommodating the interests of others to get a good, solid agreement. So I thought it was an interesting perspective.
Yeah,
so
I think
I got a different idea then of what I brought, because I started by bringing the parties together.
Yes.
I'm the guy that proposed the meeting in Washington, and I also am the one that proposed for their consideration the process design.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was partisan as well in helping the tribe kind of advance their interest and facilitated their discussions within their caucus, and was even sometimes asked to articulate what they had agreed to in caucus. But it was very dynamic.
Well,
it very
and it sounds like you are, I think, underscoring the need for us to revisit, reconsider what we mean by the importance of neutrality in these functions.
Yes, and I think we probably promote this as much or more than anyone, and that's that mediators really have to understand the negotiation process.
Yes.
That.
I like that, mediators negotiate and negotiators mediate, yes.
Yeah, and we have to understand what it takes for parties to reach agreement, because we're finding ourselves in a position of teaching, coaching
mm-hmm.
people how to negotiate more effectively so that they can reach agreement.
Yes. Yes.
And I don't think mediators get taught that way all the time.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. So when we teach mediators, the first course is on negotiation and communication. Then we go into mediator training 101 and then
mm-hmm.
advanced mediator training.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's because of our appreciation for the need to really understand partisans.
Yes.
And what they need to do to get people's attention and get them to the table, and how power fits into all these concerns.
Yes, and as a result of that, because of that sensitivity, you're not going to be likely, your mediators that you have trained are not going to be likely to have a need to suppress some of those natural tendencies that are necessary in negotiation. For fear of losing control of their mediation process.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
We understand that obviously people are going to look at their leverage and use it to the extent they can, not only bring people to the table, but during the process itself.
Yes. I want to ask you, and you again have addressed this somewhat, but are there others that you feel are doing important work in the same areas? We are, for this project, coming toward the end of this, but as we look at follow-up, are there others that you might think of that it could make sense for us to be in touch with?
I don't know that I know anyone that's mediating disputes in Indian country and working with tribes to improve
yeah.
their negotiating positions.
Yeah.
Actually, I had a thought that I don't know where you want to fit it in, but I know you asked for disappointments or failures.
Yes.
And there have been times when there have been internal controversy, but we've been ineffective in getting people to the table.
Okay.
And it's easier for me to answer that by saying, looking at where we had success. And there has to be some kind of external factor motivating them.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they don't see the need to bring their controversy to a close.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we've used successfully is where there's been such dysfunction that the Bureau of Indian Affairs has basically communicated to them that they can't maintain a government-to-government relationship until they got their government straightened out. And that means they're going to pull their funds and, stop
mm-hmm.
financial support. And that has more often than not been a cause for the warring factions to look and say, you know, if we continue, we're going to lose everything.
Tell me a little bit more about how that plays out. Is it actually in the interest of the federal government for the tribes to be able to reconcile their differences?
Is it in the interest of the feds?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The Bureau has a lot of difficulty knowing who to call, who to
mm-hmm.
relate to.
Mm-hmm.
Many cases, there are not many, but in enough cases,
mm-hmm.
there are two groups contending they're the legitimately elected
right.
representatives, and they have two councils. And what happens, because this is part of the problem with the Bureau, actually, is that the Bureau has an appeal process.
Mm-hmm.
So if one faction doesn't think the election was valid, they can contest the results, and that goes up on appeal. And what happens when people think that they can appeal it and win,
mm-hmm.
they have much less incentive trying to sit down and working something out.
Right.
So that's a problem with the BIA. Where we've been able to get the BIA to say, look, this is your problem, tribe. You have to figure this out. We could tell you how to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to satisfy one group or another. You have to figure it out. And we suggest you try mediation. That's where we're most successful.
There's
no back door.
Yeah.
And there's a powerful incentive in front of them.
Was that analogy by any chance mentioned at all? I'm sure it was in your mind. But was that lifted at all when the tribes insisted that the various agencies come together and work out some of their posture before coming to them? Because it's the same process.
You're talking about the Timbersha example?
Yes.
It was...
Do you understand what I'm...
Yeah, I think it came from the insight that there were earlier, the first round,
mm-hmm.
that the tribe was sitting across the table from people that had no marching orders.
So, yes.
So when the tribe said, what do you all think? They couldn't represent what their agencies were representing.
Exactly.
So, so that's why they said, you know, you guys have to have... give us the assurance that you're talking up and down your hierarchy during this process, because we don't want to find out that at the end that you have to now clear this with your people.
Exactly. And it seems that you have been able to use that effectively both directions, because in essence that's what the federal government is saying to the tribes as well. Look, we need you to work out who's on first?
Yes, because in negotiations, when you're dealing with the other side that speaks out of both sides of its mouth,
mm-hmm.
it's very confusing. In the course of the second round of the Timbersha negotiations, the Bureau of Land Management and the National Park Service was having real trouble together with one another,
mm-hmm.
and we could see it. And in fact, the leader of the federal team at one point asked me if I would call the director of the Bureau of Land Management back in Washington.
Okay.
And I said, John, I'm not going to go there. I said, you have to get your internal house in order, however you do it.
Yes.
But I'm not going to step into that.
Yes.
And I said that the tribe would really appreciate if you sort this stuff out, because we're looking at you across the table, and it's a little unnerving.
Yes, yes.
But it was obvious, you know, they have two cultures, different cultures, and a relationship toward land.
Yes. It's interesting to as I hear you share these different phases of negotiation, that the same circumstance is happening on both sides of the table. It is, however, it is easier to see it when it is across the table than to recognize it in one's own camp.
Right. Well, here's another interesting dynamic that took place. There was a shift, you know, a shift where from kind of sitting across the table with kind of opposing points of view, we shifted to having a common viewing point.
Okay.
So toward the end of the negotiation, actually it started pretty early, where the tribe was communicating to the Park Service what it would need in order to get their constituents to pass any kind of agreement that was reached at the table. And the federal team started very early telling the tribe what they would need. And just a perfect example is what actually the second meeting, the head of the federal team said, in the course of writing out, we wrote out a kind of protocol or a framework for negotiation, which included all the procedural agreements. And they said, John said to the tribe, he said, actually passed it to me first. He said, how would the tribe feel if we were to ask them not to mention transfer into trust, land into trust at this point of the game, because there are people above us that still haven't reconciled themselves to that within the park, but we feel that we can change that, but not yet. So I said, ask the tribe. So they went to the table and they said, we think that if we mention transferring land into trust within the park, park land into trust, at this point, we will probably lose support from the, and they, we don't want them to tell us it's off the table. We want them to include it, but we don't want to be explicit right now. So that was an agreement. They said, the tribe said, as long as you understand that we're looking at creating a permanent title to this land here, and we don't care if it's trust or whether you come up with any other kind of legal device.
Right, right. And we'll and we're hearing you, and we will give you what you need to work with us.
Yes. So it was an interesting shift in the relationship. And then the last basic shift was where team and the tribe going to these public hearings, presenting the case for you know, national legislation,
right?
And both supporting each other, no longer any kind of controversy, but presenting a united front. We had come a long way, baby.
Oh yes.
And then there was another shift toward the end there, where we had negotiated land, but now we had to negotiate water allocations for all the parcels. So in the West, you know, water negotiations can be pretty brutal. Very, very brutal. But we reached the point where the tribe and the federal agencies agreed on allocations, and the the solicitor's office came in and wanted to you know, negate the entire agreement. They wanted to insert themselves as you know, legal experts and pick apart this agreement that the Park Service and the tribe had reached regarding water allocations. And so the leader of the tribal negotiating team and the federal team both told the solicitor general or solicitor's office, bug off. You're not part of this negotiation. You're lawyers.
Yeah.
You ought to tell us how to implement what we have agreed to. Yeah. That was also really
interesting. That was a definite shift.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And that is definitely, by that time, the process is definitely valued. And I guess goes back to your visit from 4 years after. It is a foundation at this point. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting. Listen, I could go on and on and on, and as I told you, I will look forward to even beyond this interview, just being in touch with you and learning more about what you're doing and exploring ways that we might be able to do other things together. But this has just been invaluable.
I'd like to send you.
I was going
that
to ask you. I know you mentioned an article, and
yeah.
I was going to ask you about that and anything else that you might.
All right, I'll send you another little piece on what I wrote recently on mediation.
But that sounds wonderful. Yeah. And so you can just send it as an attachment? To my
I don't email? Have, let's see,
or
let me mail something to you.
Okay, that's fine.
Joan, what's your address?
Okay, my address is 551, it's Joan Walker Scott.
Sure.
And it's 551. River Hill Circle, one word, River Hill, and that's number 816, Columbia.
Oh, 816 Columbia.
Mm-hmm. South Carolina, 29210.
Oh, let's see, so it's 551 River Hill Circle, 816. That's
yes.
An apartment?
Yes.
And then the street net is 816 Columbia?
No. The street, it's 551 River Hill Circle. That's the street. Apartment. Or is that, you know, a number, suite, apartment, whatever, 816. And then the city is Columbia.
Oh, okay.
And then.
And the your zip was?
29210.
Okay. 29210.
Right.
South Carolina. Okay. I'll do it.
I thank you very, very much. And at some point, we'll have to exchange names. As I tell you, because being in the Santa Ynez area, Santa Barbara area, I'm sure we know some of the same people.
I was just there yesterday in Santa Barbara.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Adelina Padilla.
Adelina.
Spiritual. Leader there with the Chumash and
Ynez.
One of my sisters.
Yeah, and, do you know a woman named Roberta Cordero?
I know of Roberta Cordero, yes.
Yeah, Chumash.
Yes,
and
was and she works with your organization, is that correct?
Yeah,
yes.
Was associated also with the taking the canoe to...
Yes. Yes, and that's where I initially know of her work and know the name.
Yeah.
The Pagalines are, I don't know if you know that family with the Chumash, but there are others, and we can go on. And at some point, I will look forward to comparing those notes as well. But I thank you so much.
Thank you.
I will look forward to receiving that, and I will be in touch with you.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Have a good day. Bye bye.